All right, welcome back to everybody. We went through this story at the end of Shimshon's life last week, and just in order to be able to pick up sort of where we left off on the same page, everybody, I want to just do a quick reread of the events, starting with Pasuk of Bet. Vayachal se'ar roshol tzamech kashir gulach. After Shimshon was captured, his hair began to grow again as it was shaven. V'sanei plishtim ne'esfu lizboach zevach gadol ledagon Elohim ulesimcha. What page are we on?
314.
Perek tetzayin pasuk chaf gimel now.
The very last line.
Sinei plishtim ne'esu lizboach zevach gadol ledagon Elohim ulesimcha. The sarnim, the heads, the governors of the plishtim cities, gathered together to offer sacrifices to Dagon, their fish god, and to celebrate. Vayomru natan Eloheinu b'yadenu et Shimshon oyvenu, and to sing songs of victory. God, Dagon, our God, has given Shimshon over our enemy into our hands. Vayiru oto ha'am, vayihalalu et Elohim, seeing him there, captive, chained, tilling the mill, blinded, humiliated, they praised their gods. Ki yomru natan Eloheinu b'yadenu et oyvenu. God has given into our hands our enemy, the one who has destroyed our land and who has multiplied our casualties over the years. Now they got a little drunk, or they got a little overjoyous, and they said, let's make sport of Shimshon. Let's visachek lanu. Let him export for us. Vayikrul Shimshon beit asurim, they called him out of the jail. Vayitzachek lifnehem, to make sport before them. Vayamidu oto ben ha'amudim, they placed him before the pillars. Vayomer Shimshon el hana'ar hamachazik biyado, Shimshon said to the na'ar who was leading him, he had to be led by a na'ar because he was blind. At this point they had taken his eyes out. He said to him, leave me, v'hamisheni et ha'amudim, and let me feel the pillars. In other words, you're guiding me, you're walking me. If you put me against the two main central pillars of the building, then I can just stand there and I can feel the pillars. I won't have to be led. V'hamisheni et ha'amudim asher bayit nachon alehem, put me next to the two pillars that the building stands on. V'esha'en alehem, I'll lean on them and then I will have to rely on you. V'habayit male ha'anashim v'anashim, the house was filled with men and women. V'shama kol sarnei plishtim, and all the leaders of the plishtim. V'al hagag yishloshet alafim ish v'isha, the overflow. You know, when you fill a cathedral, you fill a theater, you put an overflow with a video hookup. So the video hookup here was that they were on the roof. The extra 3,000 men and women on the roof. Imagine how many were inside. All to see the humiliation of Shimshon. Haroim bischok Shimshon. Vayikra Shimshon el Hashem vayomar. Shimshon prays, cries out to God. Hashem Elokim, Zochreinina v'chazkeinina, ach hapam hazeh Elokim, remember me, strengthen me, just this one last time, God, ve'inakma nakam achat mishte enayim plishtim. And I will avenge, we had a whole discussion last week as to whether it means one last act of vengeance against the plishtim, or as many of the mafreshim translate it, I will avenge them for at least one of my eyes. Question of whether it's nakam achat mishteinai or nakam achat mishteinai. Vayipot Shimshon et shnei ha'amudim b'tavach. Shimshon grabbed the two central pillars. Asher bayit nechon alehem, vayisamech alehem, he leaned against them, he pushed them. Echad b'imno v'echad b'smolo, grabbed them, one in his right hand, one in his left. V'yomer Shimshon, tamot nafshi im plishtim. I let me die together with the plishtim. V'yet b'koach, v'yipol abayit al asranim, v'al kol ha'am asher bo. Pushed with strength, pushed the pillars, down came the house, poor architectural design. And took out all of the Sranim and all of the people who were there. He killed more people in this one act in his death than he killed in his entire lifetime. His brethren, his father's house, they all came down to this, to the rubble, to pull Shimshon's body out. They carried him. And they buried him between Tzorah and Eshta'ol, bekever Manoach Aviv, the burial, ancestral burial plot of Manoach, his father. Vehu shafat et Yisrael 20 shana, judged Israel for 20 years. And that's the end of the story of Shimshon. That's how the story ends. Bezrat Hashem, we're going to bring the story of Shimshon to a close today. So, just to summarize a couple of things we discussed last week, the phrase "Vayachel Sa'ar Rosho L'Tzameach Kasher Gulach," this phrase that the story begins with, which is a description of Shimshon's hair growing, just as he's about to, just as he was taken by the plishtim, taken, blinded, captured, pushed, put into the jail, chained, and made to tochen b'vet asurim, to grind the mill. At that point, Navi says that his hair begins to grow back. The question that we asked was, what is the significance of the hair growing back? And we offered two possibilities. One we saw in the Radak, who says that chashav Shimshon she yashuv lo kocho im sa'aro, that as his hair begins to grow back, Shimshon thought, okay, then this is a sign that his strength is going to come back with it. And that's why, ultimately, when he's in the Beit Dagon, he's able to ask God to help him, strengthen him, because he thinks he'll have his strength back now that his hair has begun to grow. That was the Radak. We asked a couple of questions or challenges to the Radak's interpretation. One of them actually was why the plishtim would allow his hair to go back. If the plishtim knew that his strength was in his hair, so how would how would they allow that? They were so enthusiastic about cutting his hair and about subduing him. Why would they allow his hair to grow back? Before we offer the second interpretation, I think it's valuable. I think it's important to see to answer that question. The Masada of Cook, Dat Mikra Tanach, it's a very good parish in general. interprets this pasuk in this way. Exactly as the Radak suggests, that Makdim Hezber, I'm just going to read, I didn't photocopy, so you'll just, I'll translate as I go. Makdim Hezber L'Sof Einyan, by telling us that his hair began to grow, it's anticipating that which will come later. L'Tzameach, right? His hair is going to begin to grow, and therefore we know later he'll have his strength back. Now we know why. Miyad kasher gulach hitchil gadel. The moment he cut it, it began to grow again, and now that's where it's going. V'aplishtim lo samu libam lachach, and the plishtim didn't notice. You know, it's an answer to the question of why the plishtim allowed his hair to go back, is that hair doesn't grow back that fast, but it began to grow enough, meaning it began to grow. Shimshon wasn't going to cut it. Plishtim didn't notice how long that didn't get to as long as it was, and therefore they didn't realize that he, with his hair, was growing back his strength. And of course, the rest of the story takes them by surprise. That was one possibility. We had suggested almost an exact opposite suggestion or interpretation, which was that the growing of his hair, rather than symbolizing the restoration of his strength, we asked a second question, which was if his strength was coming back to him, and if he knew that his strength was coming back to him, then why does he need to pray to restore his strength? Zochreinina v'chazkeinina ach hapam hazeh ha'elokim. What he asked for was not the restoration of his strength. He didn't feel that his strength was back. It seems that what he was asking for was for God to kind of restore his strength to him once, independent of all of the other issues. He recognizes that he violated his nezuot, that his nezuot was over. So we actually suggested the opposite interpretation, which is that the Navi is telling us that his hair grew back in order for us to understand that his hair really had nothing to do with the strength. That the mystery here, which was in the end of this, and if you look at the, it's an interesting textual observation, which of these two interpretations is, let's say, you know, we would support. If you look at, if you have a Tanakh that has the Tanakh divided into paragraphs, this verse, "Vayachal sa'aro shol tzamech kasher gulach," that his hair began to grow as it was cut, it's the end of the previous paragraph. It's not the beginning of this paragraph. According to the Radak, according to the Masada of Kuk Dat Mikra, it's the introduction to what's going to come next. What's going to come next is he's going to get his strength back in order to bring down Beit Hagon, and we're told that that's because his hair grew. But then it really belongs to the first paragraph, first sentence of the next paragraph. But in Tanakh, it's printed as the last sentence of the previous paragraph, which is the entire story of Delilah. He's giving up his hair, and he's giving up his secret to her, and him cutting the hair. So the placement of this verse, I think, changes its meaning. If you place the verse at the beginning of the paragraph describing the Shimshon's restoration of strength, what are you saying? If you say that, if you start the paragraph that describes the restoration of Shimshon's strength with a statement that says Shimshon's hair began to grow back and the Plishtim didn't notice, then what are you saying about his hair and the relationship between his hair and his strength? That the strength lies in his hair. If you conclude the paragraph of him having cut his hair and therefore losing his strength and being blinded and being subdued, clasped in irons, thrown into jail, tilling, grinding the mill, and then conclude, and his hair was growing back, then what do you say? And then what's the message? Then I think the message is the exact opposite. Namely,
It didn't help.
Right.
He was still bound to the mill.
That's right. That with all of this talk about hair, and he tells Delilah that his hair was cut, and that he was, and that his strength lies in his hair, and they cut his hair, and then they blinded him, and then that. Now he's sitting in jail, clasped in irons, he's grinding the mill, and his hair is growing back. So what do we gain? What we gain is an understanding that hair and strength have nothing to do with each other. And what was the real source of his strength, therefore?
God.
His obedience, his relationship with God, which was created by the oath of Nezirut. And therefore, what I suggested was that Shimshon, at that point, doesn't cut his hair, not because he thinks that his hair will lead to his strength, but because he recognizes in that moment that he's given up. He's violated that oath of Nezirut. So now he's sitting in jail and he realizes to the extent to which he has given up all of this, he allows his hair to grow back as a Nazir would.
But what do you mean he allows? I mean, how could he do anything?
Well, I mean, people in jail can cut their hair.
I mean, but he was watched, chained. I mean, I don't know. To me, that didn't sound plausible.
No, I think people in jail can cut their hair.
Or not.
With what?
Yeah, how?
I don't know. They usually
have a knife. Right.
Yeah, okay.
Where was Delilah?
The local barber comes along. Excuse me?
Where was Delilah?
We have no idea. She's out of the picture. She's out. We'll never hear from her again. Until Hollywood decides to make a film about it.
They did.
Yeah, I know. There'll be a remake one of these days, I'm sure.
3D.
Or animated. Enough Besser. You heard it here first. It's on tape. I want royalties. All right. That was one part of the conversation, which was the message that the Navi is trying to convey to us through his hair. And I think the way the message is, the way I would understand it is that the Shimshon recognizes at this point that the hair has got nothing to do with his strength, that his strength came from God, and you see that he prays to God, Zachreinina, Chazkeinina, Achapamazah Elokim. Three times he invokes God's name in that little tefillah, half a sentence tefillah at the end of the story. At Hashem Elokim, Zachreinina, Chazkeinina, Achapamazah Elokim. He uses all three names of God, Adnut, Havaya, and Elokim. It's really a remarkable tefillah in its complexity and in its brevity. So I think he understands that it's his relationship with God which is the source of his strength and not the growth of his hair. That's one part of the story. There's another set sense or series of hints, allusions in this story that I wanted to identify because I think they tell us a great deal about what's underlining the message of this story, what's driving Shimshon. Tanakh in general is very sensitive to the use of language and to the appearance of specific words that are laden with meaning. Words that appear in specific instances, specific stories that carry with them a certain connotation or a certain conjure a certain image. And if we read through the story and we listen to the tenor or to the words that are being used, they are very specific. And the question is, what image is the Navi trying to bring to fore in the description of Shimshon in this way? So I'll give you a couple of examples. So bear in mind the background, Shimshon, Plishtim, Aza, general region. Bear in mind the context of what the setting. Shimshon, the first thing the Plishtim do when they encounter Shimshon is they take out his eyes, which means he's now blind. So I have a blind Shimshon. Vayinaku atenav, don't worry about it. Okay, she'll. We have a blind Shimshon in Eretz Plishtim. Just to set the background. Starting with Pasuk Chaf Dalet, I'm going to reread a couple of phrases. Vayu'u oto ha'am v'ha'alu et Elohim ki yamru natan Eloheinu b'yadeinu et oivenu v'et machriv atzeinu v'ashir herba'at chalaleinu. The Plishtim, they see him, they cry out to God, to their God, saying, praising him, saying that their God has given their enemy into their hands. Vayi chitov libam, when they were all celebrating, Vayomru kiru Shimshon v'sachek lanu. Call Shimshon and let him make sport for us. Vayikru Shimshon mebeta asurim v'yitzachek lifnehem. They brought Shimshon before them v'yitzachek lifnehem. What does Vayitzachek lifnehem mean? They were laughing at him. And what does Vayisachek Lanu mean?
He played with us.
So why? It's interesting. So I see you've translated these two phrases differently. Right? Sachek, to laugh or to make sport. Vayisachek, laugh at him. How do they translate these two words? They translate them differently?
Sachek is with the samas.
With the sin. Right.
And this is like laughter, like Yitzchak.
So they translate, they make sport for us, and then, wait a minute,
that he may make sport for us.
So how do they translate Vayisachek?
Which one? Sachek or Sachek?
The first one.
Sachek.
Entertain us. And how do they translate Vayisachek? The second one?
And this one says sport for both.
And
this one says sport for both.
And the Jerusalem Bible
says sport for both.
Sport for both. Yes. Translates both the same way, correct?
Yes.
Interesting.
And this one says.
This one doesn't.
Dance, which I don't get
dance
at all.
Dance.
Sport for both.
They did sport for both.
Dance can also be to make merry.
I thought Yisachek was laughter, though. That's the conversation that you always think is like laughter.
But you told us, I mean, on Wednesday, remember that you change the Samach, the Sin, and the Tzadik. They were interchangeable.
Samach and Tzadik interchangeable. Interesting. That would make Vayisachek and Vayitzachek the same word. So I'll give you a couple of examples. Let's take a look, for example, at Bereishit Perek Yud Tet. Pasuk Yud Dalet. No, am I in the right place?
And this one is page 19.
Is it the right place?
This one is 19.
You said Yud-Tet, right? Yeah. Vayitzeh Lot vayidaber chatanav lukchei benotav vayomer kumu tzu'u min ha-makom hazeh. Lot turns to his sons-in-law and tells them, come, we're leaving this place. Ki mashchit Hashem et ha'ir vayhi kim mitzachek be'enei chatanav. What does that mean?
Jested.
Right.
To make a joke.
Make sport of. Right. To make fun of. Not from the word laughter, but from the word to play. Kimisachek. Had it read kimisachek, we wouldn't have a problem with with the context of the word. But it says kimisachek be'ina. Another example. Breshid lamid tet. Lamed Tet by Yosef. Pasuk. Oh, this is a very good example. Vatitpeseu bivigdol emo shichva imi. Eshet Potifar, starting Pasuk Yudbet. Eshet Potifar says to Yosef, come. Grabs Lamed Tet Yud Bet. Eshet Potifar grabs Yosef by the cloak, and the garment says, "Shichva imi." Vayazov bigdo biyadav vayanos vayetze achutz. He left the coat and he ran outside. Vayhi chiro ota ki azav bigdo biyadav. When they saw that he abandoned his cloak and ran outside. She called over, she screamed. Mm-hmm. She called over all of the people in the house to frame Yosef, right? Essentially to reverse the roles. Now, it's translated as mocking because it's essentially from the word l'sachek. But note here, and this is very important for us, note the sexual connotation. L'sachek banu. ba elai lishkav imi ve'kra b'kol gadol.
That's totally different.
Right? That's how they translate, because that's what the connotation here of lishachek banu. It's a word that is much more laden with subtlety. Mm-hmm. Where does that observation come from? Take a look. Take a look in Parshat. That should be in Parshat. Toldot. If I'm not mistaken. Perek Chaf Vav. From the beginning of the perek, Vayhi Ra'av Ba'aretz, Nevad Rav Arishon Asher Haya B'mei Avraham, Vayelech Yitzchak Al Avimelech Melech Plishtim Gvara. There was a famine in the land. Yitzchak goes down to Gvar to Melech Plishtim. Actually, before I even do this, even these two references to the meaning of the word Litzachek and Litzachek already gives us a clue as to understanding the mystery of Yitzchak's name. Why is there a mystery with Yitzchak's name? Because if you remember the story of Yitzchak's name, there's Rivka and there's Avraham. There's Sarah and Avraham, and each one responds to the promise that they're going to have a child with the same root, with the same word. And only in the case of Sarah, God gets angry. In the case of Abraham, God does not. Do you remember that little episode?
She laughed.
They both laughed. That's the issue here.
She laughed differently.
Right, so the Mephoshim explained that she laughed differently. The question is, what do you mean he laughs differently, right? That's exactly the question.
Because wasn't she mocking? She was really mocking.
Right. That's by her, right? But Yitzchak Sarah b'kirba. I'm looking for the reference by Avraham. Here, take a start with pasuk Perek Yud Zayin. Perek Yud Zayin. Vayomer Elokim alav, beginning of the middle of the perek. Perek Yud Zayin, chapter 17, starting with pasuk Tetvav 15. Vayomer Elokim alav Avraham, Sarai ishtecha lo tikrat shma Sarai ki Sara shma. This is right after the Brit Milah. You rename your wife from Sarai to Sarah. Uverachti ota, I'll bless her. Vegam natati mimena lecha ben, she'll have a child. And this child will become a great nation. Pasuk Yud Zayin, Vayipol Avraham al panav vayitzchak. Vayitzchak. Vayomer bilibo halaven mea shana yivaled ve'im sara habat tishim shana teled ve'yomer avraham el alokim lu yishma yichel lefanecha ve'yomer alokim no, aval sara yishtecha. In other words, Avraham vayitzchak vayitzchak, again, how do you translate the word vayitzchak? Is he laughing or is he rejoicing? Whereas by Rivka, when she responds and she by Sarah, where it says in Perek Yud Chet, Pasuk Yud Bet, 18:12, Vatitzchak Sarah b'kirba lemor. She internally laughed, and of course, and then God gets angry at her for that laughter. Lama zet tzachaka Sarah, and she denies it. Lo tzachakti. In all of this, Abraham responds with Vayitzchak. Sarah responds with Vatitzchak. By Abraham, God says to him, because of your tzachaka, you will name the child Yitzchak. By Sarah, God responds by saying, why did she laugh? So the Mepharshim have this great mystery of what of how to deal with the difference between them, suggesting subtleties. She laughs inside, Abraham laughs in terms of joy. Abraham's laughter is a sign of belief or faith. Sarah's laughter is a kind of mocking. But you're left with this mystery of why. Right? Why the word, one word, could mean two so dramatically different things. Unless one of the resolutions of that contradiction is that in Rivka's case, the word litzachek came from the word litzachek, meaning to make sport of, to make fun of. She mocked it.
Sarah.
I keep saying Rivka. It was Sarah's case. Whereas Avraham's context of laughter was really a function of laughter and joy.
Is that the only emotion that is that there's really a question of laughing? What is the laughing? Mocking, joy,
well,
or is like crying? There are many questions about crying. Yes.
You'd have to deal with each case by itself. That's true too.
In Avram's case, it says by Avram al panav, before it says.
Right, there's many indications that the stories are different, the context is different. My point is that the word to use the same word in so dramatically different places is ironic, and one of the resolutions of that irony is to suggest that there are actually two different roots, that the word litzachek can mean to laugh, the word litzachek can mean a synonym for litzachek or lischok, which is to mock.
Make fun of.
It depends on whether it's a tzaddik or a tzaddik replacing a samach, or a sin.
Right?
That's exactly the issue here. The other place where you see it in Yitzchok's context is, let's go back to Breshit Chaf Vav for a moment, because that's where I wanted to... Perachav Vav, 26. You remember, that's where Yitzchok repeats Avraham's exercise of suggesting that Rivka is his sister and not his wife. And in Avraham's case with Avimelech, with Paro, it led to Sarah's capture by Paro. In our story, Pasuk Chet, he goes to this exercise of saying that she's his sister. Pasuk Chet, Vahi kirchu lo sham yamim, Yitzchak and Rivka are living there over the course of time. Vayashkef Avimelech Melech Plishtim ba'ad achalon, Vayar v'hinei Yitzchak mitzachek et Rivka ishto. In that context, he realizes that she is his wife, because he sees tzchok through the window. Tzchok here doesn't mean laughter. Right? It has the same connotation as was used by Yosef and Potiphar. Correct. Because it comes from the word lischok, not litzchok. It comes from the word schok, which is laughter. Which is why Chazal have a remarkable medrash with regards to Shimshon. It's so astounding a medrash, you have to ask yourself, where did Chazal get this from? Chazal in the medrash suggest that when Shimshon was imprisoned, you have it here in the source page, in source number 2. When Shimshon was in prison, they play in the word tochen, kol echad ve'echad evilo et ishto lebet ha'asurim kedei shetitaber himenu. That they used to bring their wives to Shimshon in order that they should be able to take from Shimshon's genetic material.
They wanted him to impregnate their wives?
Their wives, so that they would have children who would be strong as Shimshon. Now,
oh my.
So you understand now, it's a remarkable medrash. What is the medrash essentially doing? What the medrash is essentially doing is the medrash is borrowing on imagery that the text has already pointed to. What imagery is that? What word in the text here is laden with meaning, begging for interpretation? When the people said publicly, let's bring Shimshon v'sachek lanu.
Is that what they meant there?
We'll see in a second. Vayikru l'shimshom b'et asuim vayitzachek lifnehem. Is that what they meant? I don't know if that's what they meant. But the connection between the word litzchok and the word lischok, which appears so dramatically in the story of Yitzchak, is something which caught the attention of Chazal. So they link the two. Remember, these midrashim often, rather than them presenting to us historical material, are presenting to us links of two stories. We've talked about this before. Right. That Chazal used these kinds of links between stories and words in order to connect two episodes. So I don't necessarily know if there was, if that's what the word here meant or that's what they intended. But I do know that Chazal saw in Yitzchak's, in Shimshon's plight, in the wording of Shimshon's plight, references that they saw as reminiscent of the story of Yitzchak. I'll go one step further. Go back to Shimshon for a moment. I'll show you another word in the story of Shimshon laden with meaning. Immediately after these two words, v'yisachek lanu v'yitzachek lifnehem, pasuk chavav, v'yomer Shimshon el ha'nar ha'machazik biyado. Shimshon says to his nar, who's holding him, who's guiding him, hanich oti, leave me. V'hamisheni et ha'amudim asher ha'bayit nachon aleihem, so that I may feel the two pillars that the house stands on them. V'hamisheni is a unique word, and it's very rarely used. What does it mean? To feel. Where else is it used? By Yitzchak. Ulai yimusheni avi. When Yaakov says to his mother, the end of Yitzchak's life, when Yitzchak is ready to bless them, and Yitzchak is blind, that I will, let me feel, that him, my father will feel me when he makes that declaration, v'kol kol Yaakov ayadayim v'day Esav. There's a very powerful phraseology here that is reminiscent of Yitzchak, and it's driven by this play on the word, your pardon the pun, Yitzchak and Yitzchak. I'll give you another example. This is actually very appropriate given the fact that we're making a bris this Thursday. There's a pasuk in Divrei Hayamim which we quote, or which we read, which appears twice in Tanakh. And we recite it, we quote it as part of the tefillah of a bris. But it often evokes comments from people who are listening without reading it, as to whether or not it's been read in error. To what do I refer? Take a look on the source page, just below the line across the middle of the page. You have a series of psukim in Divrei Hayamim. Zichru li'olam berito, God who remembers his brit for eternity. Davar tziva le'elef dor, commanding his word for 1,000 generations. Asher karat et Avraham, he made this brit with Avraham. Ushvuato liYitzchak, made an oath with Yitzchak. Ve'amidel liYaakov lechok liYisrael brit olam, and he established it for Yaakov and for Israel as an eternal chok, an eternal brit. Talking about the brit of Torah. In the Medrash, it's a reference to the brit of Brit Milah, but it's essentially the symbol of the brit of Torah. The same psukim verbatim appear in Divrei Hayamim. Sorry, appear in Tehillim. Mm-hmm. With one change. Zachar li'olam berito davar tziva le'elef dor, asher karat et Avraham ushvuato liYitzchak. So even Yitzchak's name appears as Yitzchak. Because of the synonym and parallel between Yitzchak and Yitzchak. And the relationship between these two words. I come back to this story of Shimshon and v'yitzachek lanu v'yitzachek lifnehem, the one individual who's connected to these two words most dramatically and to the relationship between them is Yitzchak. And suddenly we have this intense series of imagery connecting us to Yitzchak. And if you go back to the beginning of the story of Shimshon and his mother barren and him being born with a particular mission in life, we connected that to the story of the birth of Yitzchak. And the fact that Yitzchak wasn't supposed to be born because Sarah was supposed to be barren. And the fact that he was born meant he was born for a particular purpose or mission, which ultimately brought him to the Akedah. Go back to the months ago when we first started our discussion of Shimshon. And here we have Shimshon at the end of his life with all of the imagery bringing us back to, if the beginning of his life started with a parallel to Yitzchak, here's the end of his life connected to a parallel to Yitzchak. Where lies the dramatic connection between Shimshon and Yitzchak? Why did Chazal see? Why were Chazal trying to point out this parallel between Yitzchak and Shimshon? What is it about this story that is so dramatically connected to Yitzchak?
A lot of similarities.
What's the most important similarity?
Both women were barren.
No. That's part of the... Whenever you have a series of stories that are parallel to each other in Tanakh, parallel in language, parallel in context, parallel in... It's usually because the Navi is trying to point to something, trying to direct us to something. Right? The eyes was part of those parallels. Right? So I have the eyes parallel, I have the Yitzchak and the Yitzchak parallel, and I have Amusheni, the textual parallel, and I have the fact that they were born from barren mothers parallel. All of this drives to or points to one particular conclusion.
Missions.
Which is, right? What aspect of their mission dovetails? Where do the story of Shimshon and the story of Yitzchak collide?
Does this look like an Akedah?
By the Akedah.
By the Akedah.
That's what this story is, the Akedah. Mm-hmm. Is it the Akedah concluding differently?
Yes, he is.
Right?
Ends in death.
Right. It's the story of the Akedah with one dramatic difference.
Yeah.
One doesn't die.
Right? But the message of that parallel is very important for us. And that really leads us to the last question, which is probably the most important question, which is what's driving Shimshon here? What essentially is motivating, driving Shimshon in this last story?
He has to complete what Hashem told him, or what he was instructed to do.
Well, don't go back... Let's start from the beginning of the assumption. Was he ever instructed to do anything? I think the answer is no, right? Right? So he was never instructed. So the question is, what's driving his motivation? In fact, what he seems to say is what's driving his motivation, at least on the surface of it, is vengeance for his eye, right? Nakom nekam achat mishtei enai. Seems to be very individual, very self-focused, vengeance for what they've done to him.
But he wants to get rid of all these Plishtims.
Right. So now the question is, what's driving that motivation? Is it along the lines of the rest of his life, which is he goes into Timna and finds a wife, they violate that relationship between him and his wife, so he takes vengeance. They take the wife away from him, so he takes vengeance. They try to attack him, in other words, up until this point, every instance of Shimshon's Shimshon's engagement with Plishtim has essentially been a reaction to something the Plishtim have done to him vis-a-vis his wives or his women. So is this part of that pattern that here we have an act of vengeance for something personal? Or is there a more dramatic component to this last act of Shimshon's life?
The obvious thing, you know, I mean, this was a judge of Israel. This is the Kiddush Hashem that you can do, that, you know.
I'm going to split that comment that you just made.
Okay.
And no, it's important.
Yes.
The fact that he's a judge of Israel doesn't necessarily mean that everything he does is a Kiddush Hashem.
Right.
That's part of our assumption in Sefer Shoftim, is that not everybody was motivated but necessarily by the Kiddush Hashem factor. But in this particular case, I think you're correct.
Yeah.
The second half of your statement, I think, is very accurate, which is that I think he is driven by an element of Kiddush Hashem. And you see that in a number of very telling points in this story. First is his tefillah. which is really remarkable tefillah. If you go back to the parallel, and I put this as the second chart on your page, if you compare...
Is it remarkable for him?
It's remarkable...
That we hear it from him?
It's remarkable for him. It's also remarkable in its strength, in its brevity, and in its meaning. And if you think about put it into context, draw the picture in your mind of what's going on. Right? Shimshon, humiliated, sitting in the middle of the courtyard of the Plishtim, and what does he say? Right? I've given you the two tefillot side by side. You can sort of see it. On the left hand side is the tefillah we have now. He uses the name Adnut. When I put it here, you don't see it. In the Tanakh, you see. It's Aleph Dalet Nun Yud. Yud Ke Vav Ke. And then at the end, Elohim. So he uses three names of God in Tanakh. The three primary names of God in Tanakh are all used in this one tefillah. Zachreini Na. V'chazkeini na. The word na is a very powerful word. The only other tefillah that is reminiscent of this one that used the word na twice. Anybody know what tefillah was evoked the word na as please, I beg you, twice? You're correct.
Okay.
What was Moshe's tefillah for Miriam?
To heal her.
Right. What was the tefillah? Kel na rifa na la. Five words. Not one of them larger than three syllables. Kel na rifa na la. It's the shortest tefillah we have on record. Five words, four of them two letters each, one word, three letters. Kel, na, rifa, na, la. Twice, use the word na. Zachreini na. V'chazkeini na. Ach hapam azeh ha'elokim. It's really a remarkable tefillah. And it's full of humility. Zachreini na. Beg you. Remember me. Strengthen me. One last time. Tamot nafshi b'plishtim, he knows he's going to die. Compare it to his first tefillah. Motivated by the fact that, what drove his first tefillah? The only other time we ever saw Shimshon engaged in tefillah was back in Perek Tetvav, after the story of Lehi. What drove him to daven, to pray then?
He thought he was going to die.
Look at the irony. There he thought he was going to die, so he prayed that he should be spared. Because he doesn't deserve to die. After all, Atana tata biyad avdecha et hatshua agdola azot, you gave your servant this great victory, v'ata amut batzama, and now I should die in thirst. It's the only other time we see him engaged in tefillah. He was going to die. He turned to God and said, I'm your servant, I don't deserve to die. Now he's sitting there in the prison, humiliated before all. And what does he say to God? Now I deserve to die. Tamot nafshi b'plishtim. He knows he deserves to die. And he deserves to die not because of some minor transgression or a sense of arrogance. He deserves to die because he gave up his mission in life. His mission, his whole raison d'etre, was his nizirut. The moment he gave up his nizirut, and he gave up his nizirut willingly to Dalila. Essentially, he gave up his life. So he recognizes that he deserves to die. The first tefillah was filled with arrogance. Avdecha, I am your servant. You gave me this great victory. It's my victory. You made it for me. This tefillah is filled with humility. Chazkenina, zachreinina. The whole context is different, and I think that that's a dramatic statement about where Shimshon is at today versus where he was at a chapter ago. A chapter ago before he gave up his Nezirut to Delilah. After his great victory, the biggest victory he had had to date against the Plishtim. When he picked up the Lechi and he said, Ramat Lechi, I can do this without a Lechi. And God had to teach him a little humility. Remember our interpretation of the story of the jawbone. It's the exact opposite. He's been so humiliated. We don't need to teach Shimshon humility. On the contrary. And here he comes to this tefillah. It's one last statement driven by a motivation that we have yet to identify. But he knows he's going to. He knows he's fundamentally violated his oath of Nezirut. His hair is growing again, but his strength hasn't returned. Come back to what I said at the beginning of this year. So what is driving him? I think what's driving him is a statement that the Plishtim make at the beginning of the chapter, beginning of the story, which we read twice, but I'm not sure we need to go back and read it again. At the very beginning, the Plishtim make a public declaration. What's the public declaration? Natan Eloheinu biyadeinu et Shimshon oyveinu. God has given us Shimshon into our hands. Our God. They're in a temple of Dagon. And then the second pasuk of Dalet. Vayiru oto ha'am. The people saw him. Vayehallelu et Eloheim. They praised their God, their deity. It's remarkable. God has given us into our hands our enemy, the one who has destroyed our land and the one who has caused all our casualties. We've got him. Public enemy number one. God's done this for us. Look how strong our God is. And by implication, the message... Right. Look, our God has subdued his God. Here is Shimshon, driven by a supernatural divine strength because of his relationship with God. And in the end, whose God was victorious? There's no greater Chilul Hashem than that. The capture of Shimshon wasn't just his own individual desire to give up his Nezirut and the story is over. When you carry that kind of message, when you are the Shofet, when you carry the message of the Nezirut and the strength of that comes from God, and you recognize that at some point or another, then your downfall isn't just about you. It's about God. That's precisely the argument that Moshe mounted to God after Chet Ego. Lama yamu Mitzrayim. There is exactly the argument that Moshe mounted after Chet Meraglim. It's an argument that appears throughout the Nevi'im. Lama yamu Mitzrayim ayena Eloheihem? Why should the Goyim say? Why should the Gentiles say? Where is their God? Yechezkel describes how Bnei Yisrael, when they go into exile, create a state of Chilul Hashem because the nations of the world will declare, Am Hashem Eile Ume Arzo Yatzau, this is the nation of God, they've been exiled from their land. What happens to us in our relationship with the nations of the world is a reflection on God. Especially for those individuals who are, as Shoftim, carry the banner of God in the world. So when you see the dramatic extent of the Chilul Hashem created by the circumstances of Shimshon's capture, when he turns to God in prayer and tefillah at the very end of his life and he says, Zochreini na chazkeini na, one last time, one last act of vengeance, one last moment to bring down these plishtim. What he's really asking for is some response that would transform this public, dramatic Chilul Hashem into a moment of Kiddush Hashem. We can demonstrate that it's not their deity that has conquered ours, but on the contrary, ours that has conquered theirs. That's the power here, and that's what I think is really underlining underlining this story in Shimshon.
Kind of a nice ending for a horrible story.
Right. That's exactly the conclusion
so
that I wanted to...
Does he receive that?
Well, what's the response?
Well, it says...
What's God's response? Remember, God's response is not in what he says. God's response is in what he does. Right? He brings that when he brings the pillars down, and he brings down the entire house, and kills all those plishtim, right? Essentially, whose God was victorious over whom? Right? So I think he does. And in that regard, I think he is compared to Yitzchak on the Akedah in the Kiddush Hashem sense of what the Akedah represented. The story of the Akedah is all about person, about being willing to give oneself up to the mission that God has placed oneself in this world for. In the end, Shimshon sacrifices his life to fulfill the very mission for which he was put into this world. That's essentially the story of Shimshon. We start with this notion of his mother being barren and his life not really having been, by the laws of nature, he shouldn't have been born, and therefore he is born. He's born for a purpose. As Eshet Manoach was told, V'hu yachel lohoshiyat Yisrael miyad plishtim, and he dies in order to fulfill that purpose. That's the Kiddush Hashem, that's the connection to the Akedah. If he, story begins, there's a series of circles that conclude in this story. For example, when he was born, or before he was born, when Manoach and his wife, the end of Perek Yud Gimel, Manoach and his wife heard about the fact that they were going to have a child, what did they do? Excuse me? No, Manoach and his wife? What did they do? They bring sacrifices. So the story begins with the Mizbeach. The story ends with Shimshon and the Akedah. Shimshon's own life begins, end of chapter 14. This is really a very powerful, dramatic ending. End of chapter 14. End of chapter 13. My apologies. Batachal ruach Hashem lefa'amo b'machane Dan. Just as Shimshon is born and he grows up and he begins and God blesses him, the ruach Hashem begins to beat in the tribe of Dan, ben Sorah uven Eshta'ol, between Sorah and Eshta'ol, which is the area in which Shimshon grew up as a child. How does the story end? Years later, the last sentence of chapter 16. Vayirdu Echav, his brothers come down to Eretz, to Aza. Vayis'uto, they take him. Vayalu vayikburuto ben Sorah uven Eshta'ol, v'kever Manoach Aviv. They bury him in Sorah and Eshta'ol in the kever of Manoach, his father. The story starts with Manoach, the story ends with Manoach. The story starts with Ben Sorah Ben Eshta'ol, and the story ends with Ben Sorah Ben Eshta'ol. The story starts with Ruach Hashem, and the story ends with the Kiddush Hashem that Shimshon makes on the Yaked, on the Mizbeach of Beit Agon.
So that's why that burial, they're collecting
him. They bring him back, and they give him a burial of honor, of distinction. That's why that sentence, exactly right, that's why that sentence is so dramatic. It's the conclusion of the story. Shimshon comes back to be buried with distinction. Now think about the irony in this regard. The last time Shimshon met with his family,
they were at odds.
They gave him up.
They gave him up. They tried to extradite him. And here his family comes down to the rubble in Dagon, in Aza, to find him and to bring him back for burial of kavod. Even Yiftach doesn't get such burial. And Yiftach and Shimshon are contemporary. Do you remember the question with which we started our discussion? Shimshon, holy man or thug, right?
I just think about that.
He's so complex. He's so complex. He's so...
Look what happened in between.
Right, he goes up and down, and he's got this Delilah, and he's got the Tisha Timnit, and he's got the Zona and Aza, and he's got this engagement and that engagement. He's so complex. Kona Olamo B'Sha'achas, Chazal say. The notion, the ability of somebody to acquire his Olam, his eternal, in one act, in one moment. And if I had to ask the question, was Shimshon's mission a success or a failure? Until we read this story, essentially it's a failure. Because what was his mission? When Eshet Manoach was told that his mission was defined as, Hu yachel lehoshia et Yisrael miyad plishtim. He'll begin the process of saving Israel from the hands of the plishtim. Now, to save Israel from the hands of the plishtim doesn't mean to kill 1,000 plishtim. What does it mean?
Right,
here you have a generation born in slavery, born in subjugation, and your role as a shofet is to lead Israel, yachel lehoshiat Yisrael, to save Israel from the hands of the plishtim. In Sefer Shoftim terminology, that means that your mission is to turn the tide around so that we are no longer subjects of plishtim rule. To do that, you need not just to take out a couple of plishtim here and there, but you need to motivate the people in such a way that to lead them in such a way that they'll turn this table around. Shimshon tried and met with...
He couldn't raise an army.
He couldn't raise... The people wouldn't raise a finger to help him. So he tried and he failed. So if I ask the question from that perspective, was Shimshon's story a success or a failure? We would say... A failure, right? Here's the beauty of it. We don't know what happens next. But in this act, Shimshon has now destroyed the largest temple of the Plishtim. He's taken out the theological foundation of the story, of the conflict. Sinei Plishtim, talk about command and control. Take out the generals. He's taken out the Sinei Plishtim. Thousands upon thousands. If Bnei Yisrael can walk into Gaza, if his brothers can walk into Gaza to pull Shimshon out of the rubble, what does it tell you about where the rest of the Plishtim are at this moment in time? Right? Now, Sefer Shoftim, just to give you a bit of structure for a second, Sefer Shoftim is divided into three parts. The introduction, way back when, in chapters 1 and 2. Then the stories of the Shoftim, back and forth. Eir ben Gerot, Neil ben Knaz, Yiftach Shimshon. Shimshon is the last Shofet we learn about. Because the next two stories, from chapter 17 to the end of the book, are two episodes that, according to most Mefarshim, are actually very early episodes in this period of time. They're written at the end of the book as a postscript, as an epilogue. And we'll study them as a postscript. But chronologically, they're the end of the story. The story ends here. Which means that if I were to look at the story chronologically, Sefer Shoftim ends with this last act of Shimshon. The next book in Tanakh is Shmuel. Now, if you've read Shmuel...
The postscript doesn't go in accordance with...
Chronology? No. It's a much earlier story that is written at the end of the book for a reason. We'll talk about what that reason is when we study it. But chronologically, we go from Shimshon directly to Shmuel. We talked about that a little bit when we looked at the comparison between Eshet Manoach and Chana. You've learned Sefer Shmuel at some point or another. You've at least read Sefer Shmuel. How does Sefer Shmuel open? What's the opening context? What is the circumstances, the political circumstances of Bnei Yisrael at the beginning of Sefer Shmuel? Think about it for a second. The first... seven or eight chapters of Sefer Shmuel. It's the story of Eli and the story of Shmuel and the story of Hophni and Pinchas and the story of... Fine. But what's happening in the broader context around these individuals? What are Bnei Yisrael engaged in? Political context. They're engaged with a war. And the war is with whom? The war is with Plishtim. Chapter 4 is a major battle in Eben Ezra with the Plishtim. It's the war in which Shiloh falls, and which the Aaron is captured and taken into the Beit Dagon of Eretz Plishtim. And in chapter 5 it comes back. And in chapter 7 Shmuel leads a major campaign. Chapter 5 Shmuel leads a major campaign against the Plishtim to counter and push the Plishtim back from the heartland of Israel all the way back down into Eretz Plishtim. In other words, the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, I find, we find that Bnei Yisrael are engaged in a battle, in a war, a military campaign against the Plishtim, which is precisely what Shimshon wanted. What did Shimshon want in the end? When he walked into Timnah and he said to them, from the bitter comes the sweet, or from the strong comes the sweet, from the lion comes the honey. What did he want from them when he taunted them? He wanted to turn the table around. He wanted to turn the tables upside down. He wanted Bnei Yisrael to fight for their independence from the Plishtim. He couldn't do it in his lifetime. If I take out the two stories, postscript to Shimshon, and I read from Sefer Shimshon, and then I open the end of Shimshon, and then I open Sefer Shmuel, what do I find?
The wars he was talking about.
That precisely what Shimshon wanted to accomplish in his lifetime, the next episode, the next generation, they're engaged in it, they're doing it, they're involved. And you can't escape the irony of the fact that in the aftermath of what Shimshon accomplished in Beit Dagon, the whole table turns upside down. Bnei Yisrael come back to Shimshon. They bury Shimshon with honor and dignity. They tell the stories of Shimshon for years to come. And the motivation eventually starts to the point where Bnei Yisrael are able to assert themselves against the Plishtim and determine that it's time for them to reassert their own independence. So what he doesn't accomplish in his lifetime, he accomplishes in his death and post his death. That's the story of Shimshon.
Interesting.